This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by National Lawyers Guild activist, Los Angeles attorney Jim Lafferty. We'll take a look back at the year 2011. Kazembe Balogun, the program director at the Brecht Forum New York Marshall School, joins us to talk about his experience at the New York Occupy Wall Street movement. We get his perspective from a man who was in on Occupy Wall Street from the very beginning when there were only 100 people camped out in the park. A doomsday view of 2012 is what retired Professor Jim Petras is going to talk to us about when he analyzes the economic catastrophe that he believes the United States and the world is about to embark on.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Many people thought that with the election of Barack Obama, the pendulum with respect to democratic rights and civil liberties would swing back to where it should be. This hasn't happened. We've seen really no positive changes with Obama coming in. We recall that after 9/11, there were a number of policies that the Bush administration put into place that Obama has not changed. And I want to go over them with you so you'll understand the pickle that we're in. Bush advocated global supremacy, and they used what they called preemptive war, the ultimate war crime against Iraq. There was a roundup of immigrants after 9/11. Thousands of persons were put in jail without charges. The Patriot Act, authorizing massive government spying, was renewed by Obama and the Democratic-controlled Congress. The domestic employment of the military as law enforcement in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act has been instituted. Secret deportations occurred. Seizure of citizens as enemy combatants occurred. And in fact, it's now been enacted by law and will be signed by Obama so that even American citizens can be seized in America and tried by military courts or just stashed away forever. We've also seen the extrajudicial assassination of two American citizens, Al-Awlaki in Yemen, and then a week later, his 16-year-old son. Massive secret wiretaps in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act have been made legal. Instead of prosecuting the people who did the wiretaps, Congress, with Obama's support, made it legal. The issuance of secret administrative warrants of all kinds for records has been going on under the Patriot Act. Muslim charities have been suppressed in this country. Recently, we saw the head of the Holy Land Foundation, Elashi's appeal be denied, and he was sentenced to 65 years in prison for merely helping Palestinians. Secret sneak and peek searches go on under the Patriot Act. The classification of most government records has been exacerbated. It's a reversal of the idea that government should be transparent, that people's lives are private, that in a democracy, the records of the government should be our records. Special rendition, the outsourcing of torture, is a practice that is likely still going on. More black sites have recently been uncovered. The 2007 John Warner National Defense Act, which allows the president to deploy the National Guard of one state into another state without the permission of either governor, still prevails. Recently, Congress passed a law allowing the introduction of military commissions to try criminal cases. The assertion of the state's secret privilege to protect the government from lawsuits by victims of torture and government abuse has been upheld by the Obama administration, much to the disgust, in fact, of one San Francisco federal judge who actually asked the government, weren't they going to change their policy under the Obama administration? So we've seen over the last decade, including over the last 3.5 years of the Obama administration, a playing out of what this program talked about 8 years ago, and that's the simple fact that you cannot have democracy at home and imperialism abroad. Looking back on 2011, amid the colossal economic failure and compounded erosion of civil liberties, there were slivers of bright light to note, mainly the wonderful activism and momentum of the Occupy Wall Street movement. The subsequent pulling together of activists, union members, students marked this year as a launching of a vital new movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement. Will this emerging movement continue to build and hold together to counter and restructure a corrupt and crumbling edifice of democracy? We're joined today by Attorney Jim Lafferty, the Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles and the host of the Lawyers Guild show on Pacifica's KPFK 90.7 FM out in L.A. California National Lawyers Guild attorney, head of the L.A. chapter out there, and a longtime veteran of the movement, Jim Lafferty. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, good to be back with you, Mike.
Our program today is looking both backward and forward. We want to take a look at the record of the Obama administration, legally and politically, and then back even further than that to the beginning of Bush, and then look forward to where we're hoping to go in the future. And with that in mind, let me ask you this. You're a veteran of the civil rights movement. You were down south in the early 60s, helping the Lawyers Guild down there with the movement. You were active, in fact, one of the leaders of the national anti-Vietnam War movement in the 60s. You kept active all the way up to date, and you've been in the thick of things. Well, I know you got arrested here in New York when you were visiting, but you've been in the thick of things in L.A. too. I wanted to ask you, how did you compare the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement and the whole radicalization of the 60s? How would you evaluate that vis-a-vis what's going on today since the Occupy movement started in September?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question, and I suppose not an easy one to summarize, but if I were summarizing it, I suppose I might make a couple of points. One is, I'm now 73, I've not been as excited and optimistic and hopeful about a movement since the 60s as I am now around the occupation movement. And that's been true of a lot of other contemporaries of mine my age that have been active for long periods of time. We're thrilled with this new movement. It's very exciting. It's very broad. I think it's a lot deeper than I think the 1% would like to acknowledge. It differs, of course, in some ways, and of course, it's in its infancy in many ways, and so perhaps this next comparison is unfair. But remember, Mike, you know this better than most. During the 60s, during the period of both the civil rights movement and certainly the anti-war movement, labor unions were stronger than they are today. We had left parties that were stronger than they are today. And they were able to provide a framework of historical perspective, a framework of leadership in some cases. We talk about this being the occupation movement being a leaderless movement, but it's not a disorganized movement, and no doubt would benefit to some extent, as the civil rights movement did and the anti-war movement did, from people who had been in the battles previously. We don't have a great sense of history in this country. We certainly don't learn it in our high schools or grade schools. Many of the young people that are at the heart and soul of this exciting and wonderful, brilliant new movement are not the beneficiaries, as some of us were during the Civil Rights Movement or during the anti-Vietnam War movement, of a historical context in which to organize ourselves, if you will. Nevertheless, it's proven that you don't need that to make a splash. It's proven that you don't need that in order to get a foothold at what is, after all, the core issue in this country. It's one thing to protest for civil rights. It's even more attacking the beast where it lives, the imperialism, if you will, when you attack imperialism's wars. But when you go to the heart of capitalism itself, which is what this movement does, it's not surprising that they've been met often with some rather fierce and brutal police reaction. They were ignored by the press for the first week or two of the movement, even though it should have been acknowledged as exciting right from the get-go. Much of the press has been a distortion of its sense. You're constantly hearing from the mainstream media that they don't know what the demands are. You know, it's not specific enough. What is it exactly these people want? As though reading their picket signs alone would not tell you damn well what they want. So there are differences. There are different challenges that this movement faces. But it is in the spirit of those previous movements that you mentioned, and it is as exciting as any of them and holds great promise.
Jim, why do you say that the Occupy movement attacks capitalism itself?
Well, I mean, it may not articulate itself as saying we are a socialist, anti-capitalist movement, but when you talk about the issues it talks about, tax the rich fairly, tax the corporations, no attacks on Social Security and Medicare, house the homeless, jobs for all, I mean, that is, even if it is not articulated as sharply yet, as I think it will be, by the way, a direct attack on the economic system, the economic injustice. This is an economic injustice movement. And anybody who then looks at it from that point of view, and now it's become the conversation of the day. I mean, you hear politicians talking about the 99%. You commercials advertise their product for the 99%. I mean, it's become part of the cultural and political discourse and fabric of America today. That's threatening, I think, to corporate America, because it, however not fully articulated it is, it is a direct attack on capitalism itself, because capitalism cannot produce the kind of economic justice that these tens of thousands of people are demanding.
What was your reaction to the, we are the 99% and they're the 1%? My own reaction to that, I thought that was a brilliant formulation, because it kind of buried forever the notion that we're all middle class, you know? Here you have the movement articulating the fact that there is an economic elite, and that also captures the political elite. It's them against us.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. It was absolutely brilliant. And as I say, the proof of the brilliance of it is how it's been picked up, as I just said a moment ago, in every aspect of American life. I've told you this before, but when Bonnie and I were arrested in New York at an Occupy Wall Street demonstration, he even had cops saying to me privately, you know, we feel we're part of the 99% too, but we just can't get out there and protest whether we'd lose our job. It lays bare the notion that, you know, Horatio Alger myth, we can all make it in this country. People aren't making it, and they know they can't make it in this country, given the skewed and unjust economic system that capitalism represents. So I think you're absolutely right. I think it just hit a nerve, and the notion of, and then now you see all the more in the paper, what percentage of the wealth of the nation, the 1% control. You hear more conversation about the Citizens United case and the fact that the corporations can now openly and easily buy the next president of the United States, buy the next Congress and governors and so forth. That resonates with people who are losing their job. You know, at a time when the U.S. Census Bureau acknowledges that one out of every three Americans, that's 100 million people, are either living in poverty or are in the danger of slipping into poverty, and by some figures it's one out of two, depending on how you define poverty, people understand that. When people are losing their jobs in record numbers, when 2 million homes are currently in foreclosure and 6 million more are standing behind them underwater ready to go into foreclosure, this is something even the mainstream media can't keep from the people.
You can add to that the students whose cumulative debt to go to college is over $1 trillion. That's $1,000 billion.
Oh, you know, and law students, we work with the law students, these wonderful Lawyers Guild law students all around the country, and they want to get out of school and they want to be people's lawyers. They don't want to work for the corporation. They don't want to work for Dorkel defending some, you know, trust or something. And yet they accumulate $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 worth of debt. They don't know what to do when they get out of law school. It's that, too, is part of the economic injustice and the trap that is now being exposed, I think, by this movement.
Well, we've got an election campaign coming up. You know, it seems like the last one just ended, and now we're in the middle of another one. And I suppose that it's going to knock off track the movement as it's been accumulating since Occupy in September. What's your take on whether people should get involved in electoral politics, particularly at the presidential level?
Yeah. Two points about that, Mike. I share your fear, because you and I have been through enough of these movements to know that when a presidential cycle election comes up, anti-war movements and civil rights movements, women's movements, gay rights movements, and so forth, tend to leave the streets and begin the campaigning for who they believe is somebody who's going to be a smidgen enough better to somehow make a difference in their lives. And that, of course, is always a setback for the movement for reasons we'll get to in a moment. But you know, it's interesting, and that may happen here, and it will certainly happen for some. I participated in a teach-in at our Occupy LA encampment, and I talked about that. And I spent a lot of time in the Occupy LA encampment over the 2 months that was there. And people, one after another, said, no, we're not falling into that trap again. A pox on Obama, a pox on them all. We know that the politicians can't give us what we need. Only we can force them to give us what they need. Now, whether that holds or not, I don't know. Certainly the message that I bring and that I believe you bring to folks like this is, amen, stay with that. Don't fall for the trap of electoral politics. And we point out to them that some of the most important and significant victories in social and economic justice in this country were obtained simply because and only because a mass movement of people demanding that justice stayed in the streets long enough and built broad enough movements. The war in Vietnam ended under Presidents Ford and Nixon, hardly men of peace. They are Republican presidents. But by that time, there had been such a powerful anti-war movement, both in civilian life and within the military, that no president of any party or Congress of any party could continue the war anymore. That's the way you need to lobby, if you will, in the streets. Same thing with true Roe versus Wade, those same all-male justices who one day thought women had no right to choose, didn't just wake up one morning and because they took a pill and realized they were wrong. Hundreds of thousands of women and the supporters have been marching in the streets for years demanding that the law change, if you will. And the same thing is true with all these other movements. So that's the message, and I think that message is finally getting through, at least in greater numbers than it was during the anti-war and civil rights and labor movements, perhaps. Let's hope so.
Jim, we're going to have later on in the show our friend Kazembe Balogun talk about the Occupy movement here in New York.
Yes.
Let's just reach across the continent to L.A. and talk a bit about where you think the Occupy movement in L.A. Is going to go.
Yeah, that's a fair question. We talk in terms of phase two, if you will. We've been talking in terms of phase two for a while. You know, obviously, the Arab Spring was an inspiration for setting up encampments and civic centers and what have you. I think that was a brilliant move, and I think it put the movement on the map, if you will. I don't know that that was ever a sustainable way of operating a long-run political movement in this country as opposed to in an Arab country. And so now, at any rate, people are grappling with what is phase two. Here in L.A., one of our unions, SEIU, has already offered indoor space to the movement where they can meet and organize. We still have, as I believe you have in New York, but I'm not really sure, we still have, anywhere from 50 to 100 people a few times a week who gather on the west steps of our city hall, which is still open to the public. The rest of it's fenced in, and they hold a general assembly. Last week, we shut down a number of home foreclosure auction sales with civil disobedience and disruption, which resulted in two or three cases in the bank renegotiating the loan rather than going through that again. So the movement continues. It's not as visible, obviously, at the moment, but it's in some ways it's reaching out into the community more. We have some smaller occupations in Watts and East L.A. so that the neighborhoods most affected by the economic justice are getting a chance to participate more directly. But what the next phase, as it fully flushes out, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows, but I think the determination that's been shown when you talk to these folks, the fact that they're still organized, still meeting regularly, suggests to me it isn't going anywhere. And if the 1% thought that by shutting down the tent encampments it was putting an end to this movement, it was pipe dreaming.
Well, they didn't put an end to the movement, but we can't pretend to say that that wasn't a setback. It was.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to ask you your thoughts on the coordinated aspect of the crushing of the occupied movements in all these cities around the country.
Yeah.
They were done within short time, and it's now come to light that they were done with the coordination of the FBI, of Homeland Security. Obama was in Hawaii at the time. That may have been a convenient escape for him, because I have to believe that this was all done with consultation in the highest level of the White House.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. Mayor Kwan,
yeah.
Thank you. Spoken acknowledged that there had been a conference call with mayors and police from about 18 different cities that the FBI, Homeland Security, was on. In fact, she even acknowledged what the advice was they'd gotten in this coordinated shutdown of these encampments. One, do them in the middle of the night when people aren't paying so much attention. Two, do everything you can to keep the press away. And three, use as an excuse the fact that these have become unsanitary blights on the community. You know, there's the porta-johns aren't being cleaned or something.
And use overwhelming force.
And use overwhelming force, of course. And that's exactly what they did here. I will say they weren't as brutal here as they were in New York and in Oakland, but there was enough brutality here. There were enough examples of police misconduct that we're still dealing with, still finding out about, and still perhaps going to be suing over here. Certainly, they did it in the middle of the night. They created a quote-unquote press pool so that you really couldn't get good press coverage of how it was unfolding as it unfolded, and they used that excuse. the mayor here, who had welcomed, and he's the head of, you know, of the National Council of Mayors, Villa Grossa, who had welcomed them, the occupiers here initially, and so forth and so on, and talked about economic injustice, suddenly found himself talking about, well, it's become a homeless encampment, and there's drugs there, and there's disease there, and it's not sanitary. You know, the very problems the cities hadn't been able to control themselves and address themselves as any decent society would suddenly became an excuse to shut down these occupations who were dealing with the homeless problem. We provided all sorts of social services here at our occupation in L.A. for people who had never seen anyone from the city come and offer them a chance to deal with a medical or emotional or economic problem that they've been dealing with. You're right, and I think that shows what we started this conversation with, how critically important and central this movement is to the continuation of a capitalist imperialist society like the United States. They simply could not let it go on, and that's why at the highest levels of government they're trying to shut it down.
Let me make one observation about the coordinated crushing of the Occupy sites. It seems to me that if the bad guys are that well organized and coordinated, then we have to be too. And I wonder whether there's been any discussion along those lines in terms of uniting the movement at a regional basis, eventually at a national basis, and coordinate our efforts just like they coordinate their efforts against us.
There has been. There have been national conference calls of the various occupations talking to one another, discussions of marches on Washington, what have you. There's also, interestingly enough, been some discussion about how each occupation governs itself, because while governing by consensus is a wonderful and beautiful thing to see, it's a bit cumbersome. It takes more time than other methods of democratic governance. It doesn't always lend itself to a quick response the way an undemocratic government can do, as you say. So I think both how it's organized, how it functions internally into itself, is very much on the discussion table as I talk to these folks. I am totally confident that they'll figure out an answer to that is worthy of the cause, in the same way the anti-war movement, civil rights movement, and so forth did.
Jim Lafferty, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. And we look forward to picking this discussion up sometime in the year 2012.
Thank you, Mike.
Out in Los Angeles.
Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're joined today by writer Kazembe Balogun. He's an activist and cultural organizer from the Bronx. We talk with Kazembe about his activism within the Occupy Wall Street movement through the Education and Empowerment Committee. Kazembe is the program director at the Breck Forum New York Marxist School. Kazembe, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
Kaz, you're a longtime friend and comrade of mine, and you're the program director at the Breck Forum New York Marxist School, and you got your foot right in the door initially at Occupy Wall Street here in New York City. And I wanted to ask you, how did it start off for you?
Well, you know, it was a funny thing because the day after Occupy started, my son was born. It was kind of a coincidence because, you know, my son came out and, you know, kind of looked a little bit like me, kind of looked a little bit like her, but it was all, I couldn't tell which was what was what. And I felt the same way about the Occupy movement. It was a little bit, you know, it looked a little bit like the left. It looked a little bit like the anarchism, but it was ours. And so when I went down to Zuccotti, what I found immediately was this really kind of vibrant community that was started. Really started around with like about 100 people. The first day I went down there, and within a week it expanded to 300 and then close to 1,000, to a point where you couldn't even walk through the space anymore. And I think that it really did speak to the anger and the frustration with the current economic and political climate now within this country, where you have a 1% on Wall Street that controls so much wealth, and the average people are facing so much austerity.
What was the role that you played as kind of a liaison between the Breck Forum up in the Village and the occupiers down near Wall Street?
Well, one of the things is that as a public educator, part of the Breck Forum is that you want to provide a context for these demonstrations. You know, you had a lot of young people who for the first time are entering into public demonstration life. And you really wanted to have a conversation with them about that, you know, this is not the first time that this has actually happened. So part of the work of the Breck Forum was actually leading workshops and discussions at Zuccotti on the nature of capitalism. So, for example, we brought your comrade, our comrade Rick Wolf down there, and he had a talk with almost 300 people. We organized a talk with some Greek comrades who were part of the Public Squares movement in Thessaloniki to Zuccotti Park. And so what we wanted to do was really kind of provide a space where we were actually teaching and people were actually asking questions and leading to that. One thing I would really add is that all great movements have great literacies. The civil rights movement was buoyed by the church and the gospel singing and also the preaching. This movement has also been buoyed through a great literacy movement of journals and literature like Occupy Wall Street Journal, also buoyed by talking. So for the first time, we have a movement where people are not only learning to speak in public, but we're also learning to listen to each other. And I think that was the kind of beautiful way in which the Occupy Wall Street movement has been able to grow and blossom.
Kaz, the movement was centered down at Zuccotti Park, but it really made an attempt to reach out to the outer boroughs as well. This was done in the context of the oppressed minorities in this city, black population in this city. Talk to us about that.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, you have to understand that Wall Street historically has been the site of oppression for all people, primarily because the wall that was built on Wall Street was used to keep the Native Americans outside the business district. The first commodities sold on Wall Street were black slaves. So when we're talking about Wall Street, we're talking historically that this place being the center of world capitalism. So obviously, when we're talking about what's happening in the economic climate of the United States right now, the people who've been the most hardest hit have been black and brown communities. You know, they've been hardest hit in terms of the foreclosure rates, hardest hit in terms of the legal work, you know, stop and frisk, all these different aspects, but in much more ways, you know, ironically under a black president. People from all over New York City came to Wall Street. And what happened was they began to fan out to the other boroughs. So what we have now is we have Occupy the Bronx, Occupy Sunset Park. We had a movement only a few weeks ago where many people went and retook foreclosed homes in East New York. I was a part of a public forum where a woman from Harlem came and told her story and was able to get dozens of volunteers to come and occupy her apartment building in demands of heat for the winter. So what we're seeing right here is an attempt to recast and to really rebuild a new definition of solidarity through these public movements. And I think that that's something that's been so unique about this Occupy movement, is that people are coming together and trying to learn from each other. Very difficult at times, a lot of contention, but it is the first time ever that many people are talking. And I must also add that one of the major impetuses of the Occupy movement was the movement around Troy Davis. One of the major demonstrations and first arrest that took place was when people from the Troy Davis rally in Union Square walked down to New York to Zuccotti in solidarity. When we see a meeting of these different movements, and that's, I think that's something very powerful and it's something we can look forward to in 2012.
I've got to walk past Zuccotti Park on my way to my office, and I walk past it on my way to the WBAI studio as well. And my walk today from my office, I first went past Zuccotti Park. I want to describe it for our listeners because it really is poetic and symbolic. The park is empty. There is no people in that park. The trees are festooned with white lights, but there's nobody there to appreciate it. The park itself is surrounded by three rings of steel fences. Mm. Inside the park, there are rent-a-cops in fluorescent vests. Outside the park, there are real cops, squad cars, and one of those observation booths about 30 feet over the park, looking down at it, recording everything. So it's an absolute sterile presence. And then you get past the park, and you turn left, and you walk down Wall Street, and you can hardly walk because the sidewalks are so full of people. Why? Because the Wall Street Stock Exchange in itself, surrounded by a security fence, mm-hmm, and by like the airports, and I have to walk through to get in there. And so everybody else is pushed up on the sidewalk. You get a real feel for the oppression that they've brought down on us just by trying to walk over to the radio studio.
Right. And I mean, I think one of the things that I take from in this inspiration is that occupation is not just a place or a space, but is an action. And an idea that we can start occupying ourselves, that we can really actually step into entering into a new way of dealing with public life. I think that it's really kind of tilted the way in which the political discourse in this country has gone way past anything that that they can contain through police force. It's amazing because whenever the police tried to arrest people in the Occupy Wall Street movement, the demonstrations got bigger and bigger. And I think that in this particular period right now, where we're stepping back for a moment and really being in the space of reflection, we can really think about not only is Occupy Wall Street as a space downtown, but how do we occupy in all different types of communities? And I'm really looking forward to the spring of 2012 when there's going to be a lot more actions around the streets and a lot more work that's going to be happening. I think that's going to be a time when we're really going to see a new democratic blossoming in this country.
What kind of work are you doing now as winter is set upon us? The snows are about to fly. Spring is not quite around the corner. But what should we do now? What are you telling people that's going on now?
I think there's a number of things. I think the first thing for us is this really kind of continuing to plug into our local occupation movements. As the media kind of turns its lens away from occupation, there's going to be a temptation to kind of consider it kind of passé and not in style anymore. But I think that it's really that folks within the occupation movement need spaces to do work around reflection and where the movement's being taken. I, for myself, I'm taking a lot of this time to really dig in terms of helping being a part of the Breck Forum, really opening the space of the Breck Forum to Occupy movement so we can have those spaces of reflection, of thinking about where to move next. And I think that's where we really need to move forward, is like just take the time in the winter just to kind of think through, be reflective and kind of move forward from there.
Is there a way for our listeners to get a hold of the Breck Forum and the Occupy movement if people want to get online? What should they go to?
If you want to get a hold to the Breck Forum, which is a fantastic New York City institution of an anchor of the New York City left, you can go to www.breckforum.org. We have plenty of classes, lectures, film screenings, all from a radical left perspective. In terms of Occupy Wall Street, you should go to the NYGA.net, the New York General Assembly website, and also OccupyWallStreet.org for updates on Occupy Wall Street.
And Brecht is B-R-E-C-H-T. Kaz, if you had your druthers, and now you've got your young son Miles growing up, what kind of world would you like to see come out of all this? What kind of world would you like to see Miles grow up in?
I would love to see a world where Miles grows up in feeling safe and secure, knowing that his life is just as important as any other person's life, but also having a sense of a freedom and a liberation and knowing that and not being scared. I think that that's where we're leading to right now. I think that we have two sides of the history right now. We have one side where we have the 1% and their rules and their regulations, and they're telling us to work insane hours or have no work at all. And there's another world that we can think of where we can actually live a fairly decent life and have time to be fully human. And I think that's the demand. I think that our needs have shifted in the society. And I think the demand is not only for economic equality, but also a decent life. And that's the only thing I really want for my son.
Kazembe Balogun, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much. And shout out to my partner, Claudia, and my son, Miles Huxley. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We'll be right back.
We're glad to have Professor Jim Petras from the School of Sociology at SUNY New York Binghamton back on Law and Disorder. His latest article, published on globalresearch.ca, Unrelenting Global Economic Crisis, A Doomsday View of 2012, is a profound reflection on the direction that the world economy is going into. Professor Petras is the author of more than 62 books, published in 29 languages, and over 600 articles. Jim Petras, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
It's a renewed pleasure. Jim, you wrote an excellent article that's been up on the net called A Doomsday View of 2012. And you start off by saying that the economic, political, and social outlook for 2012 was profoundly negative. Talk to us about that. Why do you think that that's true?
Well, because the economy has never really recovered from the recession. All the trends from the early spring onward have been on the negative side. The projections of the so-called experts was that this would be a year of recovery, a transition to a major takeoff in 2012. We see the opposite taking place. Slowdown in investment, a slowdown in overall exports, a slowdown in terms of financing the employment. What we do see is a tremendous gain in profits for the big speculators. The speculators are back with a vengeance. Carlyle has reported over $12 billion in profits for the first 11 months. So the speculators are working. The housing market is terrible. I see this phenomena facing a real recession, but with the added features that the debt has skyrocketed so much was thrown at the bank bailouts, that there isn't enough resources to pull us out of this recession. In other words, the so-called stimulus package that ameliorated the last crash, 2008 and 2009, isn't available. The debt is too big. The deficit is growing. The export markets that Obama promised are not materializing. And on top of it, the Democrats and Obama are making deals with the Republicans to actually cut back on federal spending because of the deficit. So I see us moving into recession by the end of the spring and then heading toward worse recession or toward a depression by the end of the year. And this is all going to be exacerbated by the move toward a war with Iran, which will push oil prices up over $150 a barrel. The powers that are moving toward that war, particularly the Zionist power configuration with Howie Berman in the Congress, letting in pushing on the international committees, I see us heading toward a major war with Iran, and the consequences will be very, very catastrophic for the economy of the United States. Instead of looking for a drop in commodity prices, which would help a recovery, I see us pushing toward greater war spending, which will break the Treasury. So that's the basis, that the speculators are back in power. The housing market is negative. The job employment is negative. The trends the last 3 months of 2011 are negative and moving down toward recession. I don't see any counter moves. The usual Christmas shopping is giving the illusion that somehow we're coming out of this because retail consumer confidence has improved. But this is very relative and very peripheral to the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, which are negative. The deficit's negative. Accumulated debt payments are negative. I don't see any possibility of a injection of major public spending which would turn this around or at least ameliorate it, keep it at zero growth, keep us at stagnation rather than in negative territory.
We've had a number of guests on talking about reflecting first backward and then looking forward. What would your evaluation be of the Obama administration? That's the first part of my question. And then I'm going to talk to you about what kind of political forces you'd like to see in action going into the next year. But first, give me your overall take on the pluses and minuses, if there are any pluses, of the Obama administration.
Well, it's worse than the Bush administration, one of the worst in American history. Obama did nothing, actually, to stimulate a new structure in the American economy which could take government support and move forward. What he did was pour the money into the people that caused the crisis, Wall Street, and they've made a recovery, but that hasn't helped the real economy, the job-creating economy. He did nothing for the relocation of plants, taking government handouts and then investing it in China and overseas. So his accommodation to Wall Street, his unwillingness to put some discipline in American investors to have them take government support and tax write-offs and build up the productive capacity here, they moved offshore, those are major failures. And then his escalating the wars in the Middle East and building for a confrontation with Iran, imposing sanctions to satisfy Israel, which cuts off American business access to very lucrative markets, his hostility to Venezuela, which is a major oil exporter to the United States, neglect of Latin American markets in favor of truckling to Israel. Now he says he's recognized Asia after 3 years of chasing Al-Qaeda, 50 Al-Qaeda agents in the mountains of Afghanistan. He's come around to realize Asia is where the action is. What does he do? He signs a military agreement to put Marines in Darwin instead of pushing for greater U.S. exports into China, technology, agriculture. There's huge markets in Asia. Just ask the farmers in Iowa. Just talk to the port workers in Seattle and San Francisco. That's where the action is. Instead, he wants to exclude China from any greater Asian free market agreement. The Trans-Pacific Agreement is that he's promoting with all the minor league countries in Asia is built to exclude China. That's not going to happen. Every single Asian country has massive ties with China, investment ties, trading ties, technological ties. And he says he wants to get into Asia by excluding and confronting in a new Cold War the major player, the major dynamic element in the Asian paradigm.
Yeah, well, that's why you mentioned Darwin. That's Darwin, Australia. That's why they're stationing troops there right in the northern coast of Australia, right
it's
south
nonsense.
Of China.
It's nonsense. No one's going to build a wall around China. That's 1950s politics. I mean, he's sucking his thumb and getting his ideas.
Jim Petras, let me ask you to turn your attention towards politics here in the United States. What do you think is going to unfold in the next short period, 2012 and so on, after the election? I'm assuming that Obama will get reelected. But in any case, I think that the economic situation is not going to change for the better. How do you think politics are going to unfold
after
in the next period?
After Obama gets elected, you're going to see the most horrendous attack on the Social Security programs, Medicare, Medicaid. He's holding back because he wants to get elected. But once he's elected, he's got in his top drawer plans to slash Social Security, plans to cut back on Medicare coverage, privatization of Social Security in installments. And that's going to be part of his debt cutting. He's already cutting into Social Security. So-called payroll tax is a Social Security tax. So that's the one thing he cuts. He doesn't raise taxes on capital gains. He doesn't tax Carlyle and all these huge speculators. He's looking to slash and burn the only social programs that sustain American living standards for millions of workers who paid into this fund. This isn't an entitlement program. This is social insurance that has been paid for by American workers. And that's what's going to happen if he's elected, and he's going to go into Iran because he told the Reform Jews in a recent message that all options are on the agenda, and he stationed the American Armada Air Force relocating from Iraq, smack facing Tehran, and that is a move toward war. Today, they announced when they said, we're going to impose sanctions so Iran can't sell its oil. Well, Iran says if we can't sell the oil, nobody's going to get any oil, and we're going to close the Hormuz. The Navy says, we're going to open it. How are you going to open a pass when they have 10,000 missiles heading into that short waterway? There's no way they can prevent Iran from closing the Hormuz. And that means an act of war, and we're into it. Obama's agenda, war, cuts and massive cuts in social programs, that's the outcome of an electoral victory.
I read today in the New York Times that they were going to close the Straits of Hormuz and prevent oil shipments. And the Times said that this was in reaction to Iran's developing a nuclear capacity. And it struck me that that was the same kind of coverage that the New York Times gave when Bush said that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, ties with al-Qaeda, and therefore we had to take him out. It was a lie, and the Times perpetuated it. There's no evidence that Iran is working towards a nuclear capacity. The Times doesn't challenge that. They just go along with the party line that Iran is a nuclear threat in the same way that Iraq was supposed to be a threat.
Well, I think you have to go to the source. Read Netanyahu and Barak, the defense minister, a war minister of Israel, and the prime minister of Israel. Then the message gets transmitted to the New York Times. Then it gets transmitted to Washington. You get a third hand. I mean, why not just look at the press releases that come out of Tel Aviv if you want to know what tomorrow's news is going to be and what the president's going to say in his next press conference? Why get third-hand information? All they do is put a gloss on and say, well, it's in America's interest. What is a boycott of Iran oil going to do for the oil price in America, the gas pump? We're going to pay a higher price. That's not in our interest. Why are American oil interests excluded from buying and selling gasoline with Iran? Is that in our interest? No, there's only one country that wants to dominate the Middle East, and that's Israel, and it's to their interest to confront Iran like we destroyed Iraq, which was an adversary of Israel's colonization of Palestine. It's in Israel's interest that Muslim countries be stigmatized, but it's not in any businessman's interest. It's not in America's consumer interest to have oil prices rising and us cutting ourselves from lucrative markets. The Chinese, they don't organize sanctions. They benefit from. They're right on the firing line with Iran. If there was any nuclear threat, they would be the first ones threatened. Iraq is next door to Iran. They're not talking about any Iranian threats. So I think we should just be a little bit practical, reasonable, and observant. And all these headline news that comes out of the New York Times or out of the mouth of Obama, and you can see what lies they are. Our interest is in opening markets and trading and having lower commodity prices so that consumers have greater purchasing power in the United States. We should stop peddling these lies for the interests of Israel and their fifth column in the United States.
Jim Petras, you wrote in your article, A Doomsday View of 2012, that the events of 2011 were a dress rehearsal for a new year of full-scale trade wars between major powers, sharpening inter-imperialist struggles, and the likelihood of popular rebellions turning into revolutions. Could you reflect more on that, please?
Well, the fact of the matter is that we're heading toward a recession. A recession means there'll be less markets available with the same number of competitors. So Europe is looking for markets. They are entering into a major crisis. In fact, the European Union is breaking up. Southern Europe is in a deep depression with double-digit unemployment running to 20% or more in Spain, Greece, and Portugal. Italy is heading into a crisis. They can barely find a reasonable price for their bonds. They're into negative territory. So with a shrinking market, you intensify competition. Countries trying to get out of recession are trying to build up their own industry. So protectionism is on the rise. China is opening up opportunities for trade, but the U.S. is calling for sanctions and restrictions. Charles Schumer and company, instead of taking advantage of opportunities, Chinese investment in the United States is a threat. They say that China is closing its market, yet their imports are growing faster than their exports. So we have this possibility of getting out of the crisis. Instead, we're building up hostilities and fomenting protectionism. And the collapse of the European Union, with no help from the United States, of course, there's very little the U.S. can do at this point, given its own deficit, means that Europe is shrinking. Europe is going to protect its markets as best it can, the only exception being Germany, which has an export capacity to make up for any losses of domestic market. They will stimulate what they can, but that's not on the agenda right now.
What do you think this portends in terms of rebellions and revolutions? What do you think the political situation is going to be like?
Well, I think we're in for surprises. If you look at the picture, we have this Occupy Wall Street movement, which grew and fizzled. We have the trade unions, which are putting tens of millions of dollars into Obama's campaign. The trade union officialdom, all representing 9% of private sector workers, don't have an agenda. They don't have any political leadership or social leadership. So I think what we're going to see is something new coming out of this great discontent. I see the possibilities of a third-party candidate. Who knows where it's going to come from, the Greens or some other political entity. We see the libertarian right moving to present an alternative. They pick up the bad smells coming out of Washington. We have to postulate the idea that the underlying crisis in America, which is going to generate massive foreclosures, massive increase in unemployment, massive bankruptcies, that out of this maelstrom, this is going to provoke some new kind of uprisings. Now, I can't prognosticate exactly the form they're going to take, whether they'll come from the left or the right, hopefully from the left, but we're building for an explosion, and I think a lot of people don't see it. They think either the U.S. are going to just go out and vote like sheep for one of the two parties. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think the Republicans or Democrats are going to attract as many votes as they think. And I think a lot of people are looking outside of the two parties. They're looking outside of the electoral arena. They want to put an end to this horrendous situation that we're confronting. But I can't tell you the form it's going to take, because this is something which is not present in some organized fashion at this point in time.
Jim Petras, we're going to dust off our crystal ball a couple of weeks from now, get you back on the show, and talk about where we think things have gone and where they should go. But in the meantime, we truly appreciate your being on Law and Disorder. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Want to hear Law and Disorder again? Go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.